I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Gary Bain and I'm in Shea Hart this morning with Peter Hart, surrounded by great war memorabilia and washing.
There's a lot of washing in this room, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I am busy about
Sorry, when I say washing, I don't mean great war washing.
It's not a lot of that. Gary, the punters want to know what we're doing, not what we're surrounded by.
I've been there since the Great War.
Oh, he sighed patiently.
The tea towel battle of 1915. Anyway, today is the third in our mini-series, and probably last.
What were the others called, Gary?
The other one was called The Middle Years, I seem to recall, and I presume the first one was called The Early Years.
Well, I think Majuba Hill, I think we just called that one, but yeah.
But this is Ian Hamilton and the Gallipoli landings of the 25th of April 1915, although we do touch on some of the other actions.
Is there going to be a change in tone, do you think, in our approach to Hamilton?
I might speak like this.
That would be very amusing.
No, I think... Possibly not. I think the whole point of this is to show how he grew and developed into the officer that he was at the time of the Gallipoli landings.
And then the wheels fell off.
and perhaps explain subsequently some of the reasons for those failures.
Yeah, that's what we're interested in, isn't it? So we'd better look at what happened to him after the Boer War, hadn't it? He had a stream of senior appointments after being Chief of Staff to Lord Kitchener at the back end of the Boer War. So what did he do, Gary?
Oh, he was the Quartermaster General from 1903 to 4.
Blimey. He was a British observer during the Russo-Japanese War of 1904. He wrote quite interesting books about that. And by that time, he'd reached the rank of Lieutenant General. And he was Sir Ian Hamilton, Gary. Gary.
Ooh, Gary. So he must have done something right.
You're not Sir Gary, are you?
No, he was He had the Southern Command from 1905 to 1909.
Very important. Adjutant General, very important position, 1909 to 1910. And then, funnily enough, not quite so important a position in some ways. What was that? What was his last one?
Well, he was the Mediterranean Command and Inspector General of Overseas Forces from 1910 to 1914, which was headquartered in Malta, where he spent a lot of his time. And, quite nice too, I think.
Lovely. Do you think the war had come a little too late for him?
I presume you're referring to his age. He was 61 by then.
Aren't
so
you 61?
No, nearly. Although he was appointed as commander of the Home Forces, he was probably sidelined from the action in 1914.
But then a great sort of general, captain on a white steed rescues him. Although the word rescues isn't probably the right word. Who comes to his rescue?
Well, Kitchener, he recalls him from the wilderness, as it were, trusting in his old chief of staff and wanting to capitalise on his relatively recent experience in the Mediterranean theatre.
Oh, so he recalls him to the wilderness to do what?
Well, he's going to command the amorphous force that was gathering in the Middle East, which would become known as the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force, which we'll probably refer to as the MEF from this point.
MEF.
On the 12th of March, 1915.
Now, he was appointed, to make it clear, Lord Kitchener's Secretary of State for War, so he can do this. He also has a habit of acting as if he's Commander-in-Chief of the British Army, which is not helpful, really. Now, so Hamilton is sent out, and after the naval attempts fail on March the 18th, Hamilton realises that it's all down to him and the MEF. And what does he write? One thing about Hamilton is you can't trust a word he bloody says, in some senses, from now on, because he's writing in his so-called diary, which was written after the events. It was written after the war. So we ought to be aware of that before we go on.
And I'd also like to make the point that the 18th of March is a date that is much celebrated in the Gallipoli area. When you're there, you do see
all the time
reference to it all over the place.
All over the place.
And this is what General Sir Ian Hamilton of the Headquarters MEF says. I am being most reluctantly driven to the conclusion that the Straits are not likely to be forced by battleships, as at one time seemed probable, and that, if my troops are to take part, it will not take the subsidiary form anticipated. The Army's part will be more than mere landings of parties to destroy forts. It must be a deliberate and progressive military operation, carried out at full strength so as to open a passage for the Navy.
So entirely different from what it... I mean, this is mission creep on a large scale. There was a mass of strategic confusion in the War Council back in sunny London. There's already a sizable number of troops arriving in the Eastern Mediterranean. And they're going to be who Hamilton has under command to support the Navy. The Navy... What would make the Navy try again after the failure 18th of March? There's one thing that will allow make them try again. What's that?
Well, they would only do it once the Army had seized the Khalid Bahia Plateau.
You've been on there.
At the back of the European forts, yes. How is it known locally?
Big Bastard.
Because?
It's big. Mm. It's a bastard to think of taking it.
Now... It was a bit of a postponement, if you like, waiting for that to happen, but it wasn't a cancellation.
No
one considered that the Army might fail, yet there were plenty of professional observers who were already seriously concerned, especially amongst the High Command, watching in askance, from the Western Front. And this is one of our favourites, General Sir Douglas Haig, Headquarters 1st Army.
Colonel Hankey, Secretary of the Committee of Imperial Defence, arrived to see me. He's over in France for 3 days. He states Lord Kitchener is more hopeful as regards the ammunition. That's a bit irrelevant. But as to the Dardanelles operations, I asked why the naval bombardment had taken place before the military part of the expedition was on the spot to take advantage of it and cooperate. He quite agreed with my view and said the operation had been run like an American cinema show, meaning the wide advertisement which had been given to every step long before anything had actually been done. And that this is quite a widespread view from senior commanders on the Western Front. So we'd better look at who these troops were. Who did Hamilton have? They come from all over the world, don't they? Are they thrown together with lots of careful planning and forethought?
Well, I think the clue is in the word you just used there, thrown together. So he had two French divisions who were well-trained, good artillery, and, most importantly, plenty of ammunition.
Next up, I think we'll have my favourites, the Royal Naval Division, badly trained, no practical experience other than an absolute disaster at Antwerp, and no artillery. So they're not really a division, they're Churchill's favourites. There's nothing wrong with the men, we'll keep, they had potential, not military efficiency. Who else, Gary, who else?
Well, the 29th Division... who were scraped up from around
scraped
the Empire.
Up. That's a bit harsh, Gary.
Well, they'd never trained as a division. So so how would you describe it?
I'd say scraped up. And they are not the elite fighting force people think they are. They do perform well, but they are not a division again because they haven't trained together. They've got no... Right, who else? Though, according to their own country, this is the only troops who were there. Who are they?
Well, the Australian and New Zealand Army Corps, good material, but little training and absolutely no experience.
And then lurking in the background, there's the Indian Brigade, which are fine troops, and we'll come back to them in another podcast. But also, there was the 42nd East Lancashire Division. Where did they come from, Gary?
Generic Northern.
Generic Northern, yeah. Aye. They're TA. They're not TA.
Well, the Territorial Force.
Territorial Force. What's their training like?
Well, inadequate, I think, is how we
experience?
Would describe it. Inadequate.
Yeah. Now, take it as a whole, a lot of these formations are not very well trained. They've got very little experience of working together in higher military formations, you know. So they're not used to working in brigades or division. They're just not. They're short of artillery. And for the British, ammunition is terrifyingly scarce. It's farcical. What about the senior commanders, Gary?
Well, most of them are inexperienced in modern warfare. Their staff had little practical experience, which, you know, would have enabled them to have any chance of dealing with the appalling administrative, communication and logistical problems that would face them on a daily basis.
Well, I think you're saying this is a disaster waiting to happen.
This was a disaster waiting to happen.
And who would deliver that disaster?
Hamilton.
Yes, I'm afraid so. And we've got another quote for you as Hamilton. What does headquarters MEF, what does Hamilton say?
At once we turned our faces to the land scheme. Very sketchy. How could it be otherwise? On the German system, plans for a landing on Gallipoli would have been in my pocket, up to date and worked out to a ball cartridge and a pail of water. By the British system, I have been obliged to concoct my own plans in a brace of shakes almost under fire. Strategically and tactically, our method may have its merits, for though it piles everything onto one man, the commander, yet he is the chap who has got to see it through. But in matters of supply, transport, organisation and administration, our way is the way of Coney Hatch. Now, for those that don't know, Coney Hatch was a psychiatric hospital in Barnet, near where we are
now. Walked past it many times, and I've actually been in it's had then the longest corridor in the world or in Europe.
So how would you describe General Sir Ian Hamilton's comments there, Pete?
Utter bollocks. I'm sorry, because Hamilton does spin off into not quite reliable witness. We'll come to this time and time again. The question of forcing the Dardanelles or landing on the Gallipoli Peninsula was not new. It had been discussed and dissected time and time again over the last 50 years. There's one interesting fact which there are memories of on the peninsula. What's that?
Well, that the British and French forces had occupied the peninsula for a time in both the 1850s and 1870s.
Now, a series of papers and reports about the possibility of a naval attack with or without military support on the Dardanelles had been carried out for the War Office in 1906. And what was their result?
Well, don't touch it with a barge pole.
Yeah. They'd revisited this and it's not really possible. And this is what the problem is with Gallipoli. You'd have to have the entire BEF there to make any chance. Now, what's the prevailing culture, military culture? Why is it that Hamilton, we have to have some sympathy for Hamilton? Why is that?
Well, because I think what you're alluding to is that the military culture was such that Hamilton couldn't make what seems to be an entirely reasonable demand for a set of fully evaluated combined operational plans conditional to him accepting command of the Mediterranean Expeditionary Force.
No, he can't, can he? He's hamstrung by his... he's got a sort of subservient relationship with Kitchener. And he's not the sort of man to kick up too much fuss. Well, I'm going to make a condition on that. He's not the man to kick up too much of a fuss at the time. He never stopped kicking up a fuss afterwards.
Well, by which time it was too late. And now you're going to tell us what General Sir Ian Hamilton says.
Where are your well-thought-out schemes for an amphibious attack on Constantinople? Not a sign. Braithwaite's set to work in the intelligence branch at once. But beyond the ordinary textbooks, these pigeonholes were drawn blank. The Dardanelles and Bosphorus might be on the moon for all the military information I've got to go upon. One textbook, one book of travellers' tales don't take long to master. Now, there's the rub, because he's lying. And the maps in his possession that they got issued with were not good, but they were adequate for the purposes of operational planning. What do I mean by this? What do I mean by this?
Well, he had, for example, a 1:63,360 map, which had been prepared in 1908. It was based on an older 1:50,000 map from a French survey made during the Crimean War in 1854. Additional information had been incorporated to create a 1:40,000 enlargement in March 1915.
Now, for over 100 years, the naval hydrographers...
That's easy for you to say.
It's easy for me to say. They're people who map the watery bits. Consular officials, spies, we call them, Gary. Military and naval attaches,
spies.
Intelligence officer,
spies.
Definitely spies. Even civilian yachtsmen,
spies.
Had all channeled intelligence by open or clandestine, that's also easy for me to say, back to Britain. But this is a great example of one of them. What's that?
Well, one naval officer had even prepared a 4-inch-to-the-mile map with accompanying comprehensive notes covering the direct route between Gaba Tepe and the Kilid-Bahia Plateau in 1876.
Now, what's interesting is a lot of these reports that were funneled into the War Office settle on the Gaba Tepe sector as the best landing spot because it's got roads leading directly to Maidos and Kilid-Bahia. And it's that we all know where Gaba Tepe is. It's to the south of the ultimate Anzac landing site. But it's also interesting, it's where the Camatel, just near there to Camatel, where we go and stay on our holiday.
And Maidos is modern Echebe, is it?
Yes, that's right. Now, these various reports were collated as secret documents by Naval Intelligence in 1908 and the War Office in 1909. But there's regular updates. They never stop gathering intelligence. There was a consular official in Chernakle who never stopped. Now, we want to pay tribute to two authors who very much done the groundwork for our blatherings here, haven't they? Who are they?
Well, nearly all of the material has been convincingly argued by Peter Chassot and Peter Doyle in their book Grasping Gallipoli, Terrain, Maps and Failure at the Dardanelles, 1915.
Now, and they make it clear what's available to Hamilton and staff, and they make it clear that he is lying, I'm sorry to say. And if he didn't have it in London, he had it as soon as he got out there.
Well, certainly early briefing meetings in the theatre. There was also the opportunity for personal observations carried out from the sea, which augmented by a series of beautifully drawn panoramas of landing sites, which were then, in turn, duplicated and made available.
Yeah, a lot of those young sailors had a very artistic bent.
Finally, there were the efforts of 3 Squadron, Royal Naval Air Service, who were able to use their aircraft to conduct a series of pioneering photographic reconnaissance missions, which recorded with considerable accuracy the locations and ongoing changes in the Turkish defences.
So what you're saying, Gazza, is that whatever Hamilton might claim, the information he required in making his plans was available. The question is, how did he use it? Now, what would you say that there's rules of war, isn't there? There's like gathering the main theatre, concentrate on the main theatre of war against the main enemy, various things. There's one of the big, important principle of war. What's that? That they break time and Haig referred to it. What is it?
The element of surprise. There'd be a real...
That was a surprise to me.
There'd be a real problem in securing any kind of surprise. The desired objective of securing and forcing the Dardanelles Narrows was plain for all to see.
And it had been since the bombardment on the in early November. It's just ridiculous what they'd done. However, so strategic surprise is not possible. What is still possible?
Tactical surprise, to some extent. But only if they came up with a plan that could isolate the disparate elements of the Turkish forces. Hamilton, therefore, sought to confuse the Turkish commander. And I'm going to tell you what General Sir Ian Hamilton says. The first and foremost step towards a victorious landing was to upset the equilibrium of Lyman van Saunders, the enemy commander of the 5th Army. I must try to move so that he should be unable to concentrate either his mind or his men against us.
Now, he's got some advantages in doing this, none of which he took advantage of, I have to say. What are these advantages? Well, the first one is that the Dardanelles splits the Turkish forces. So they've got some in Asia and some in Europe. That's one thing. What other advantages do we have?
Well, the marching distance between Helice at the tip of the peninsula and Buller,
that's at the neck of the peninsula,
was measured in days rather than hours.
There's something else as well. What else might delay the Turkish troops?
Well, they could be delayed by the rough ground, which we know fairly well how rough that is in modern equipment, when marching to the landing site.
A clear and well-defined path has always been my route. It just ends in disaster and prickly bushes. Now, right, sorry, I may have got distracted by personal memories there. Now, so there's a potential for Hamilton to cause Liman.
Who? Liman.
He was a personal friend of mine. Liman von Sanders. Very great difficulty. But he's also, there's other, so that's one thing. But Sanders, Hamilton has got other things on his mind.
He's got to consider the trade-off between unexpected landing points and the best locations to allow rapid advance to secure the narrows.
So if you land at the best landing beaches or close to the objectives, you're going to find the Turks are ready and waiting. So it's better, but the Turks are there.
Less obvious indirect route, that might allow the troops to get ashore safe and sound, but the inappropriate nature of the beach...
Think Wye Beach.
Wye Beach comes immediately to mind. The distance to be travelled or the rough terrain would give ample time for the Turkish reserves to block the approach to the real objectives.
Right. Now, the planning process starts late, not entirely Hamilton's fault, but, and one decision had been provisionally taken by Birdwood, that's General Sir William Birdwood, who was commanding the Anzac Corps. It was swiftly endorsed by Hamilton and his Chief of Staff, Major General Walter Braithwaite. And what are they going to issue? What are they not going to touch with their barge pole? What are they not going to do?
They're not going to land at Belair.
But surely that's every amateur strategist and everybody who goes to Gallipoli when you're going that they all say, why didn't they land here? It would have been great.
Yeah, and indeed, it was Liman von Saunders' main fear.
It was.
But as far as Hamilton was concerned, there's a series of fatal flaws in this superficially attractive
idea.
Are
you saying I'm superficial?
No, I'm saying you're super.
Oh, thanks, mate. Well, let's go through. What if they landed at Belair, they'd be on the northern, or if you like, Constantinople. We will put a map up, probably. Probably after you listen to this, and about 2 days later, the map will appear. They'd land on the northern or Constantinople side of the Turkish defence lines across the isthmus. Where are those lines come from? You've seen some of them.
Yeah, yeah, and the trenches and forts, they date back to the Crimean War. But they had been recently modernised and improved by the Turks.
And we visited one of those forts. It's fantastic, isn't it? The guns aren't there anymore, but the fort is. It's fabulous. Great place to visit. There's something else. If you land at Belair, so you land on this little narrow 3-mile isthmus, and there's a big load of lines between you and your target, what else is there?
Well, you're vulnerable to attack from both sides.
So there's Turks on the southern... The Turks will lie to the south, but there's also Turks to the north.
Yeah. Now, there were two Turkish divisions specifically placed there by Liman von Saunders to thwart any such landing.
How many battalions were facing the British 29th Division at Helles? Well, have a listen and you'll find. Then think two divisions. So there's two whole Turkish divisions. Right.
Now, the occupation of these lines, it wouldn't cut off Turkish supplies and reinforcements to the peninsula, as their sea routes would be completely unaffected.
Now, the other thing is geography. Is Belair next to the Narrows?
It's nowhere near, is it,
no,
really?
It's 20 miles away. That's a guesstimate, so don't get your bloody measuring tapes out.
Please do.
Oh, bastards.
The increased distance from their only feasible base at Mudros would have stretched an already strained line of communications to breaking point.
Now, they also decided not to do... So they're not going to land at Belair. They're also not going to land on the Asiatic coast. They do make a small landing, but we'll come back to that. Why are they not make a serious assault in Asia? And this is quite controversial again. So what are the ranges of opinions about a landing in Asia?
Well, some thought that the openness of the ground would give the relative freedom of manoeuvre impossible on the cramped Gallipoli Peninsula. However, others feared that the expeditionary force would be exposed to full-scale continental operations once the Turks mobilised their forces. As the Allies advanced towards Chanak...
That's Chanakkale now. Yeah.
...and their objectives, they would be leaving all of their right flank and communications terribly exposed to counter.
Yeah, because it's the big country. It's wide huge. Open, and yeah, so yeah. The Turks can just, they've got more troops available. As if this is not enough, somebody else had said they weren't landing in Asia. Well, was that, and Kitchener, why is that important?
Well, Kitchener said it was not to be attempted, and as we've said, he's not going to argue with him.
And at that point, we'll take a short break to think about what we've just heard.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Welcome back. Now,
so we're not landing at
Belair. We're not landing at Belair, and we're not landing on the Asiatic side.
Where are we going to land?
So it leaves the Gallipoli Peninsula itself.
Now, you look at your map, any map of Gallipoli. What does that reveal?
It's that the domination of the straits meant that the Khalid Bahir Plateau immediately behind the European forts would have to be secured to achieve Hamilton's aims.
So that is the main objective, the Khalid Bahir Plateau. Right.
Now, there's several obvious-looking landing beaches, but they all had some disadvantages.
Well, I can think of one straight away. Can you guess what I'm thinking of?
Suvla Bay?
Yep, Suvla Bay. Lightly guarded, but there's a problem. What's the problem of landing at Suvla Bay?
Well, the line of march would either cross or pass either side of the Sari Bayer range, which rises to 971 feet.
We've often discovered the height of that. Remember when you thought it was 9 meters? Yeah. Now, Hamilton knew from the aerial observation that there was strong Turkish forces in the Begali area. That's behind Sari Bayer, as you know. We've been there. That's where Atatürk's headquarters was as well. That's a bit of a diversion anyway. They'd have an excellent chance of intercepting and holding up the British well before they got to Khalid Bahir, because Suvla Bay is nowhere near Khalid Bahir. Right, there's other beaches. Where are the other beaches?
The area of Gaba Tepe.
Either side.
Yeah, although to secure the beachhead, the covering force would still have to get a measure of control on the Sari Bayer range. They would have every opportunity to do so before the Turkish reserves could arrive.
So this is where Hamilton decides to strike. He's going to make a night landing of the Anzac Corps on the beaches north of Gaba Tepe, which were not yet well defended. And the main force would then push on to seize the conical-shaped Maltepe Hill feature before next day launching an attack to capture Khalid Bahir itself in association with the...
So not much, then?
No, not much. And I'm going to be General Sir Ian Hamilton, who discusses this aspect of the plan. He said, I would like to land my hell force in one, like a hammer stroke, with the fullest violence of its mass effect, as close as I can to my objective,
the Kilid Bahir Plateau. But apart from lack of small craft, the thing cannot be done. The beach space is so cramped that the men and their stores could not be put ashore. I have to separate my forces, and the effect of momentum, which cannot be produced by cohesion, must be reproduced by the simultaneous nature of the movement.
Yes. Yeah, I'm going to repeat what you said earlier. That is utter bollocks.
It's utter bollocks. It's a fatal decision. There's no logic to it. There's many, many beaches stretching either side of Gaba Tepe down to, and they could have landed down towards Suvla, all those beaches, and they could have landed there. The covering force would land round Gaba Tepe, perhaps north of Gaba Tepe, but then the rest of the divisions could have landed on the Suvla beach and then moved to their support. Most people who've thought about it now think that the only way, if there was a chance of success, the only chance of success would have been to land as a concerted push on Kilid Bahir, a real hammer stroke, smash through straight to it. It's not far from Gaba Tepe. The beaches either side to Kilid Bahir. You can see it, which is why we call it a big bastard. I would point out it still looks like a wall across the horizon.
Yeah. Now, to make matters worse, Hamilton resolved to divide his forces and make a series of supposedly coordinated landings all around the Helles tip of the peninsula. But as we've said on numerous occasions...
Sorry, I'm sighing.
They're not able to support each other, so they're not coordinated at all.
No, they're not. And it's just bloody stupid. Again, there are a couple of the main landed beaches were considered well guarded by the Turks. But the idea was, although they were defended, what were they relying on? They weren't relying on the army for this. What were they relying on?
No, the Navy would be able to pour in supporting fire from all three sides, pounding the Turks into a state of submission. The main beaches were identified as...
V Beach, that's in front of the Sedulbar Fortin village, and that was well defended.
W Beach, which is just further around the Helles Cape.
And that was well defended. And then Hamilton goes into the realms of bloody fantasy. I'm sorry to swear. I very rarely swear, as you know, Gary. He has a lot of, let's go, surprise. Can you imagine me doing those thingies with my hands? Subsidiary flanking assaults at less likely landing points, mainly because they're not bloody beaches at all. What's the first of them?
X Beach. Which is towards the northeast of W Beach.
A bit further round, isn't it?
And it's not really a beach at all.
There's a sort of artillery road coming up from... I think that was there then. I think that's put there by us. By the way, it's fallen in recently. So that's one. And then there's a better beach in the other one, S Beach in Morto Bay. That's just below Detot's Battery. They're going to land there as well. And what is the point of these? I've no idea.
Hamilton also decided to place a force further up the western side of the peninsula between the Turkish forward positions and their local reserves with the intention of breaking their communications.
Where was that at?
Y Beach.
Y Beach?
Why, it's now but a thing. Cliff. I was going to say, it's at the bottom of a very steep gully.
We've
gone down it and up it. And it's ludicrous.
And there's some great pictures of you struggling through. I might put one of them up as well. It's one of our favourites, isn't it?
The Helles operations would be the responsibility of the 29th Division, who we mentioned earlier, augmented by the Plymouth Battalion of the RND.
So what's the timetable for success?
Well, it was certainly ambitious. It involved the capture of the dominating height of Achi Baba behind the small village of Krithia by dusk.
I'll step in now, yeah.
On the first day.
The first day?
Followed by a determined push next day in concert with the Anzac Corps to sweep the Turks from Kilid Bahir.
And then as Matt McLaughlin, always says, and then beer and sausages on the third day. It's just, you know.
But that wasn't all. To counter the possible impacts...
You're not going to say he's got more attacks?
Yeah. To counter the possible impact of the Turkish Asiatic batteries firing into the back of the landing forces at S and B beaches, it was decided to land a French force at Kumkale, which would have the additional advantage of confusing the Turkish High Command as to whether the landing was real or not.
Well, that's it, though, isn't it? There's nothing else.
Nope, still not all. Hamilton also approved diversionary operations without any actual landings by the French off Besika Bay.
Now, that's on the Asiatic coast round, well, near the island of Tenedos, yeah.
And by the Royal Naval Division in the Gulf of Saros to threaten the Bulair lines. Yes. Now, unfortunately, in putting forward these plans, Hamilton cast aside any slim opportunities that they were before him. Instead of forming a cohesive, focused plan and sticking to it, he adopted, at least in part, almost every option that lay open to him.
Now, the rest of it I've got to read very carefully because I tried to create the effect of, in my Gallipoli book, the effect of Hamilton's plans in a single sentence. And I'll read it to you now. I think it's a work of genius. I don't know, really. It goes, it wasn't that he couldn't make up his mind. It was that he needlessly overcomplicated everything. Like a sentence bespattered with clauses, subclauses, and tangential, God say that, meandering syntax. His plan layered main landings, support landings, diversionary landings, and distracting demonstrations. And it's bollocks. What's he trying to do? We've already discussed what Hamilton's trying to do. What's he trying to do?
Well, he's trying to confuse von Saunders to prevent him concentrating the Turkish forces against the landings.
Ah, I could see a problem.
Yeah, he totally failed to concentrate his own forces, which left them vulnerable to defeat in detail, thus mirroring the mistake of his masters in London.
Who shouldn't have sent them them there in the first place? They're splitting up their forces, failing to concentrate on the Western Front, so it's just the same bloody shite.
It wasn't only that. The operations were also predicated on a belief that as soon as the British got ashore, the Turks would cut and run. They're not regarded as a European enemy in the terminology of the time. This meant that Hamilton felt he could take risks that he wouldn't possibly think of against the German army.
Them Germans, no. Is he alone in this? Is he alone in the mistakes he's making? Do we have to say that Hamilton is just a complete bloody idiot?
No, in fairness, it was also the perceptions of many senior British army officers in 1915.
Now, even so, his divisional commanders are quite worried, aren't they? And you know, the one I like to use for this is the one that people think is an idiot. We did a whole podcast about how he was an arsehole, but he wasn't an idiot. And that's Hunter Weston, Aylmer Hunter Weston. And you're going to read a quote from Major General Aylmer Hunter Weston, and he's commanding the 29th Division. I'd like to point out he'd been a colonel just a year before, and now he's a Major General. Here he goes. What you got to say for yourself, Aylmer?
No loss would be too heavy and no risks too great if thereby success would be attained. But there is not in present circumstances a reasonable chance of success. The return of the expedition when it has gone so far will cause discontent, much talk and some laughter. But it will not do irreparable harm to our cause, whereas to attempt a landing and fail to secure a passage through the Dardanelles would be a disaster to the Empire. The threat of invasion by the Allies is evidently having considerable effect on the Balkan states. It is therefore advisable to continue our preparations to train our troops for landing and to get our expedition properly equipped and organised for this difficult operation of war, so as to be ready to take advantage of any opportunity for successful action that may occur. But I would repeat, no action should be taken unless it has been carefully thought out in all its possibilities and details, and unless there is a reasonable probability of success.
And I also want to point out that he also, in another letter or somewhere, I can't find the quote just now, he said that...
It was a letter to his wife.
Yeah, in a letter he says that if they did land, they'd get stuck halfway up Hellas Peninsula like a cow up a tree. I always thought, I could cow up a train. But the point is, I think Hunter Weston has got it smack on, and he represented these views to higher authority. What happens?
Well, unhappily for the men, if one thing was certain in the British Army of 1915, it was that when push came to shove, the can-do mentality would surface amongst senior officers.
So there he is. He's got perfectly reasoned arguments, and they are. That was a really sensible and intelligent piece of writing there. So what happens?
Well, he buckles to and he makes the best of a bad situation and muddles through. So Hunter Weston swallowed his doubts and he's determined to do his best to overcome the challenges.
Well, I have to say, you remember his order of the day to the men? It says, you may be faced by machine guns, shells, mines, but many of you will die. So he's still worried, but he just gets on with it. Do they have a choice? I don't. You see, the prevailing, I mean, if you object, you're out. I don't, it's very difficult to know.
We're criticising him. It's such a change. He does go from being probably vehemently against it to becoming one of its biggest supporters simply because he thinks he has to do it in order to make it successful.
It's his duty. His duty to make the best of it. Anyway, now the Hellish landings. Are they night landings like Anzac?
Nope, they're going to be made by day. Hunter Weston was vehemently against the risk of landing at night in uncharted waters with possible strong currents and feared the awful confusion that might result.
And do you know what? Again, I'm ambivalent about this. We felt the current. You've been on V Beach. You felt the current as it swirls round from the entrance to the Dardanelles, which is only, well, it's there. It is the entrance.
I think it's a 3 or 4 knot current, isn't it?
I don't know what that means, but it's fast. And it can carry you away and all sorts. Hamilton favours a night landing as at Anzac, of course, but he lets his subordinate have his way. He's got this. Hamilton has developed the position that the executive responsibility lies with the commander of the battle. In this case, he didn't see himself. As he just set the task, it was Hunter Weston's job to achieve it and to make the key decisions, as in to land during the day.
The apparent confidence of Hamilton and his senior staff utterly bemused some of their subordinates when they realised what was about to be attempted. Certainly, the results of many of the recent aerial and naval reconnaissance seems to have been simply ignored, to the chagrin of those who had spent considerable time collecting that intelligence. And to represent that, you're going to tell us what Lieutenant Geoffrey Ryland, HMS Ark Royal, says.
Yeah, he's a bad-tempered bugger, Ryland, but I like this quote. During the past few weeks, we were instructed to show on the chart of the peninsula all places where landing was deemed to be difficult or impossible, owing either to defensive measures by the Turks or the unsatisfactory character of the beach, including exposure to bad weather. This was completed and forwarded through the usual channels. We received the operation order for the landing and were amazed to find that the army had decided to land at nearly all the places which we had reported as being either difficult or impossible. So I was convinced that if the landing was successful, it would only be at the expense of very heavy casualties. There you go. Now, we'd better have a quick look at what happens with Hamilton's plans, hadn't we? We're not going to go into this in great detail. Because it happens first, 4:30 in the morning or whatever it is, Anzac, what happens there?
Well, the Anzac Corps had undergone the bare minimum of training, yet it had been given a task under Hamilton's plans, which in clichéd parlance would have daunted Napoleon's old guard.
All his young guard.
They were to make a night landing on a hostile shore.
Hard.
Overcome an ill-defined Turkish opposition.
Turks are difficult, but they didn't believe that.
Take control of the high ground surrounding the landing beaches.
Always difficult taking high ground.
And then push across the peninsula to seize Maltepe, the cone-shaped hill.
You have to say that or you're cursed.
Otherwise I'd be cursed. Thereby severing Turkish communications on the peninsula.
And that's just the first day.
Yes.
They haven't really mentioned tea and crumpets, but they probably should have done. Now then, they've got to help the British. They've got to stop the Turkish reserves arriving. They've got to cooperate with the British advance on the big bastard of Khalid Bahir, which, by the way, you very rarely hear mentioned after the first day in anything by Hamilton and his acolytes. They always start talking about Achi Baba and Hill 971. Now, that's what's going to happen. What have they considered? Somebody else who's involved in this?
What? Do you mean what the Turks might do in response?
So what is the Turkish plan?
Well, the delaying tactics of their screens near the landing place, the possibility of ferocious counterattacks by their concentrated battalions, they were treated as irrelevancies in Hamilton's scheme of things. It was a brilliant, tripwire defence, tripping up the enemy until the reserves could arrive.
Yeah. So basically, they're only trying to slow down, find out what's happening, and then smash the buggers at night because they're frightened of the fleet's guns. Yep, that's...
To emphasise the point you were alluding to earlier, the result was a disaster, although just one Turkish company of the 28th Regiment faced them during the initial landings made on the 25th of April 1915.
And I want to make it clear, in the initial stages, on the beaches, no machine guns. We've talked about this before, that it, what you hear is often other machine guns on your side. The other thing is that you know what's on your side, you're guessing at what's firing at you, and it's always difficult. And we know the Turks' order of battle, don't we? What do the Turks use so brilliantly at Anzac?
Well, the natural advantages of the rugged terrain.
Rugged's probably an understatement.
To stymie the Australian troops advancing to contact across broken ground through tangled undergrowth. That really is an understatement.
It really is, undergrowth. Yeah. So what do they do?
Well, they snipe the officers, the NCOs, and the men of good character trying to push forward. I'd have been all right.
I was just going to say that you'd have been saying, I'll help the officer back to the beach.
Now, just to make matters worse, three more Turkish battalions arrived at about 0800 under Colonel Sefik Akir.
Yeah, now, he was our man of the match, as far as we're concerned. He was a brilliant commander. So they then engage the troops, stop them, although they stopped themselves in many ways. And then what really puts the boot in?
The 57th Regiment arrives under Colonel Mustafa Kemal at around about 10 a.m.
Yeah, it's a dodgy figure. That's anywhere between 10 and 12. But 10 will do for now.
But the Anzac advance had already been stopped on Second Ridge by Colonel Sinclair McLagan.
Yeah. Ooh, did you pronounce that? McLagan.
I was tempted, yes. Who was commanding the covering 3rd Brigade, and he was charged with gaining the 3rd Ridge inland.
So there's three ridges, Ridge 1, Ridge 2, and guess what the 3rd Ridge is called?
Third Ridge. And that was to cover the landing of the main force, ready to push on to seize Maltepe, cone-shaped hill. But he acted on his own responsibility, and he didn't perform the role of a covering force at all.
Yeah, and that means as the battalions land, they there's no defined front line on that third ridge. So they just get thrown into action willy-nilly.
But to be fair, I've been there a number of times now, and I still don't know which one's third ridge when you're looking across at it.
It's very difficult. It's very difficult. Well, the second ridge is the one that all the battles are on and is the famous one. And the third ridge is that one that's a long way away ahead. How about the general commander? We haven't mentioned him before, Major General William Bridges. Does he perform well?
Well, he's not able to wrest back control of the situation. He never is. Units arriving on shore were fragmented as they were pushed sort of willy-nilly into the line.
Willy-nilly is a good word, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, at the end of the day, the situation was so bad that Hamilton's senior commanders seriously considered evacuation.
Well, yeah, they did. And that's Birdwood. It's everybody is worried. And they consult with the naval commander in that area, Admiral Thursby. And Hamilton decides to stick it out. And he writes a famous letter to Birdwood. And you're going to read it for us.
There is nothing for it but to dig yourselves right in and stick it out. It would take at least 2 days to re-embark you, as Admiral Thursby will explain to you. Hunter Weston, despite his heavy losses, will be advancing tomorrow, which should divert pressure from you. Make a personal appeal to your men and Godleys to make a supreme effort to hold their ground. P.S. You have got through the difficult business. Now you have only to dig, dig, dig until you are safe.
Godley's the commander of the Australian and New Zealand Division. So that's diggers, eh?
So they dug in and they held their ground. But after the first few days, they could not and did not make any renewed effort to attain their real objectives of Maltepe and the Kilibahia Plateau. And they never got to Third Ridge.
Yep, for the next 3 months and until, we want to make this clear, that until the August offensive, the Anzac beachhead is basically a holding camp for the Australian and New Zealand. They achieved nothing in those 3 months other than defend themselves from the Turks. Now, this whole thing is against military good sense, isn't it? But there is something we want to say, just in case people get us wrong. It was heroic, wasn't it? The Australian defence at Anzac and the establishment of that ridiculously small beachhead is fascinating. It's heroic. It shows incredible guts and determination. What importance does it have to the campaign as a whole?
None.
Yeah. Now, let's go to Helles. So it turns out that, this is where the campaign will be decided. But you know what? There's a lot of sneering by some of the British at Anzac myths about that. You know, I mean, possibly I could be perceived as having just sneered at them there. I don't think I was. But the British definitely have their own bullshit, to use a highly technical term, about the fighting, haven't they? So what sort of things do they claim?
Well, it's often claimed that the landings were somehow a military achievement of the highest order.
No, they weren't. They utterly bodge the landings, the British. They make mistake after mistake at every level of command, from second lieutenant to Hamilton. They miss any opportunities, and they're very brief if there were any. And they ludicrously exaggerate the scale of the opposition that they are facing. Who are they facing?
Just one battalion of Turks, which is roughly 1,000 or so men. They faced some 12,000 British troops. Yet they succeeded in keeping them penned back to the beaches for most of the first day.
Yeah, just the 3rd Battalion, 26th Regiment, and a very few, a company or so of the 2nd Battalion, 26th Regiment. No machine guns. They've got Nordenfelts, which are a type of machine gun. They've got very little artillery support. They've got very few feasible landmines. But what have they got?
Good leadership, experienced, well-trained troops, and above all, they had their rifles.
Yeah, and they were good on the rifles. There's a lot of crap. They were better on their rifles than the British were on theirs. Possibly not the 29th Division, but we'll come to that.
And they had motivation. They're defending their homeland.
So let's run through the disparate landings that Hamilton insanely puts on. So what are they?
Wide Beach, nothing opposed, but they did nothing and then were kicked off with their tails between the legs next day.
So a complete waste of time. That was to divert the Turkish reserves, and the Turkish reserves did for them. Yeah. X Beach, that's a land that... This isn't really a beach. They land, it's opposed by 12 men and a Nordenfelt or two. They land okay. I think one of the Nordenfelts is at the Tower of London. I think we saw it last time we went there.
It is, yeah.
They landed okay, but they did very little again, and they panicked when counterattacked by a Turkish company, which was referred to as Thousands. They basically do bugger all.
S Beach, the landing faced just one platoon from the 2nd Battalion 26th Regiment, took the Tots Battery, and then they did...
Nothing. But that's what they've been told to do. They've been told to wait there. We always use this as an interesting exercise in command, don't we? Because they've been told to hold that line of hills until the others come up with them. But if they'd left and gone to help out at V Beach, then, the Turks might have reoccupied the reserves as they came up. So it's interesting, but they did nothing. So what happened to the two main landings? Let's talk about them.
W Beach. One company gave terrible grief to the 1st Lancashire Fusiliers.
Just one company of Turks, then?
Didn't have any machine guns, concentrated rifle fire, but thin defences.
And this is shown by the fact that we've followed the tracks of Brigadier Stuart Hare, who acts as a second lieutenant, climbs up the cliff on the left-hand side and turns the corner. And the beach is very soon afterwards taken. Then they're held up by Turkish defences further inland. And there's one very key vantage point now, which is where the Turks were and held them back. Where's that?
The Helles Memorial.
Oh, you do know that.
Which is on...
how do you pronounce what it was called then?
Guji Baba.
Not bad effort, better than I would have made.
Now, the other main landing site, B Beach.
Yeah.
Now, the Turks did recognise the importance of this beach, and it was seriously defended by the Turks with trenches and lines of barbed wire.
Yeah, and now the only method of landing then, this is the first landing against modern weapons ever. Streams of was just open rowing boats towed by steam launches and then rowing the rest of the way. And there's a bit of brilliant initiative by Commander Edward Unwin, who comes up with a plan for a merchantman to be converted into a sort of prototype landing craft. And this was a river glider. It had gangways down the side and a makeshift sort of bridge at the front made up of barges. What happened?
Well, I'd just like to make a point here. This is daylight and a landing craft is coming with holes cut in the side. Where do you think the Turkish might aim?
At the holes and at the front.
Now, the troops coming ashore were shot to pieces and achieved nothing for their outstanding heroism.
So what's gone wrong? Well, you've mentioned it. That they hadn't thought it through, had they? They hadn't thought it through.
No, I mean, the commendable imagination showed in the conception of the River Clyde scheme had not been matched by an equal attention in working out the nitty-gritty details which would be needed to be attended to if they were to execute the scheme successfully.
Is this a bit like TfL with Crossrail?
Yeah, absolutely. The Trojans of legend had no idea what lay within the gift left by the Greeks.
Ooh, there's a big horsey on the beach.
That indeed was the whole point. At V Beach, the Turks could plainly see the gangways. They knew what would happen when the ship ran aground, and they had more than enough time to train their rifles on the exit ports. The concept, risky at best, demanded a night landing.
Yeah.
At least a couple of hours before dawn, when the Turks would have been unable to discern what was going on, and wouldn't have known where to concentrate their fire.
Yep, there's not enough Turks. There's just another company at V Beach, another 250 of the battalion. That's all there are there. They couldn't cover all the options, and they wouldn't have been unable to have effective fire control. They just not thought it through, the British, and hundreds paid the price. So what went wrong overall at Helles?
Well, the Helles landings cannot be taken as a whole, as they were not interlinked operations. But each landing ended up as a separate operation. No feasible communication of the time could have dealt with the problem. Turks were able to just about control the situation.
Absolutely. And this business of grossly overestimating the number of Turkish forces, it dominates the whole day. They thought there was a division defending Helles, not just a battalion. And they hear their own machine guns and they think it's the Turkish ones. A sort of minor platoon or company attack like at X Beach is seen as being thousands of Turks coming at them. These fears really hamper the British, don't they? Just as much as the actual Turkish heroes of the 3rd 26th Regiment. And there's another thing. Although they overestimate the numbers, they underestimated something else. What was that?
Well, the skill and determination of Turks who were there. The outnumbered Turks had fought with supreme combination of skill and courage.
Yeah, sticking to their positions. They hold on to the point where surrender is it's the only feasible option, and they're not going to get that surrender accepted. They're going to get butchered. And that's the root cause of the British defeat. I want to make this quite clear, and I know you do as well. We sometimes get away, we start talking about Hamilton's bad plans, about this, that, and the other. But the real reason they got beaten was by the Turks.
The Turks were good soldiers, particularly in the defensive.
And it may have been the first landing to be made in the face of modern weapons, but the British could hardly have done any worse. Or the Turks any better at things. Now, what happened to the French then at Kumkali? We haven't really mentioned that. That's to cover the arse, if you like, of the British. Is that a successful landing? In part it is. They land, the Turks counterattack. There's no point looking, it's not there. The Turks counterattack, and what happens then? Well, the British call for help, so the French evacuate and are then put on the right-hand side so that
the position of honour, so they have Asiatic Annie firing at the backside and other artillery pieces for the whole of the campaign.
Yeah, so that's another failure, another waste of resources. What about the diversions? How do they go, Gary?
Well,
Belair and Bazika Bay. How do they go?
Well, they don't really trouble the Turks at all. For all Hamilton's flailing attempts to conceal his intentions, the end results were unimpressive.
Yeah, Liman von Sanders is worried about Belair, even a bit worried about Bazika Bay, but they don't really affect it. The divisions aren't, the diversions aren't seriously pursued. I mean, Bernard Freiburg swims ashore. That's about all it is at Belair and lights a few flares. It doesn't hold them up long. What happens?
Well, it causes a delay of a day or two in the dispatch of divisions to the real landing sites at Helles and Anzac.
Yeah.
Once von Saunders had defined the location and strength of the most serious threats, the diversionary actions ceased to weave their spell. First, the 5th and 7th divisions were put on the march from Belair towards Anzac and Helles. Then a couple of days later, the 11th division was dispatched from Asia.
And let's not forget, at the same time, 15th and 16th divisions set sail from Constantinople. 12th division starts to come march down from Smyrna. And but even by the end of April, the clock's running down for the British. So let's sum it all up. So what do we think of Hamilton's plans?
Well, scattergun approach of making 7 separate landings and 2 full-fledged diversionary operations meant that the Allies didn't have sufficient strength of troops landed at one location to force a real emergency response from the Turks.
Yeah, attacked at almost every feasible landing site, the Turks were able to hold on for long enough with their tripwire defence for the local reserves of both Helles and Anzac, and they held on while Liman von Saunders works out exactly what's happening and diverts his arriving reinforcements as appropriate. Or Kemal Ataturk does it. Mustafa Kemal does it as well. Yeah, it's just stupid.
Well, Hamilton's plans relied heavily on the Turks not putting up any serious opposition to the naval bombardment, but the battleships were too far off the coast to achieve the necessary accuracy, and even when closer, their flat trajectory gunfire made it almost impossible to hit the Turkish trenches lining the brow of the amphitheatre.
That's what beaches are, we've told that.
Or tucked away on the reverse straps. What you need are howitzers.
Yeah, you need up and down.
Up and down. At both Anzac and Helles, it's not a matter of doubting the courage of individual soldiers.
Absolutely not.
But more of accepting an endemic military incompetence, lethally combined with inexperienced troops who had had no experience of modern warfare.
You know, Gary, and one thing is to remember, it was only 1915. The war had only just started, only, mass repeating, 8 months before, and few of them knew what they were doing when the guns started firing. So we are down on Hamilton. He had great experience. He'd had a wonderful career. But the wheels are coming off at Gallipoli, aren't they?
They are.
Do we blame him entirely?
No, I'm not sure there are many others that spring to mind that would have done any better.
Absolutely. And one reason for that is it was an impossible task.
And also, it detracted from the main theatre of the war, which was the Western Front.
Absolutely. All right, well, we'll be having a look at Hamilton's later career at Gallipoli in a later episode. Later. Thank you for joining me for this podcast, Gary.
Thank you. No, thank you.
No, thank you.
Thank you. Cheers, Pete.
Cheers. Thanks for listening to the show.
Yeah.
If you'd like to support us, you can now buy us a coffee. Visit www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH. And we'd be jolly grateful.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com. Code program.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?